Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Aaron Smith. Aaron Smith is the author of Appetite, an NPR best book, and finalist for the Patterson Poetry Prize, the Lambda Literary Award, and the Publishing Triangle's Tom Gunn Award, and Blue on Blue Ground, winner of the Agnes Lynch Sterrett Prize. His chapbooks are Men in Groups and What's Required, winner of the Frank O'Hara Award. His work has appeared in numerous publications, including Pleiades, Prairie Schooner, Plowshares, and Best American Poetry 2013. A 2007 fellow in poetry from the New York Foundation for the Arts and poetry editor for the literary journal Bloom, he is assistant professor in creative writing at Lesley University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Aaron. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're really happy to have you back at Prosody. You've come from Boston, and although you've lived in Pittsburgh a couple times, so we want to claim you also. But
I'm happy to be claimed by Pittsburgh, and I'm happy to be back at Prosody to discuss writing with you.
Okay, so you're going to start with a couple poems from your second book, Appetite.
Yes. Hurtful. It's true I've never been able to defend myself against your white T-shirt, and that for most of last summer, I confused wanting you with wanting not to be lonely. There are four words in the English language that have no rhymes: orange, month, silver, and purple. I want more than anything to prove that wrong, and the closest I've come is hurtful. So let me clarify. Finally, I do not love you. Who could take a lifetime of your bad poetry? However, there are things I hate you more for: that you can eat French fries and exercise, that everyone you let be close to you has to need you, strangers gawking because you're radiant, and you are radiant. Spring Rush. The college boys have pulled their shirts off and are playing football on the lawn. Their farmer tans pink in the afternoon sun. They toss and jog, slight fake and almost tackle. One puts his face too close to another one's stomach, grabs the guy's waist steady to keep from falling. Then a damp armpit on the back of his neck as a blonde wraps his arm around him in a quick guy hug. I am older and pretend not to see, furtive in sunglasses, looking at them, past them, at them. I could ruin the game by watching the wrong way, professor gawking at students. Even a shift between them could change everything, a hand more than smacking an ass, someone pressed too long against a humid chest, crash of skin, body pushing body into perfect crush, their biceps bulge, unbulge, bulge again. It's not that I want them. I've had enough men, and yet I can't stop looking at them while trying not to look at them. Make him think you could pull a gun. Make him think you're crazy. Make him think you could pull a gun. He'll remember you this way. Men respond to grand gestures. Men respond in their deepest parts to fear. Tell him you've met before, you're sure of it. You never forget a face twisted in pleasure, panic. Watch his mouth dissolve, watch it betray him. Show him a knife slicing a body, more surprise than pain. He'll pretend he's comfortable, that you really don't scare him, but it's all an anxious lie. You've seen the movies, and every scene is your scene, the psycho singing love songs to the man he loves, blood, a perfect sunset on the dead mother's cheek. You can taste that light. Tell him nobody belongs to him more than you. Let him think he has some room. Let him think he can choose. Side Highway, Meditation. This evening, New York looks how it always looks in photos, except more flawed, like someone picked it up and didn't put it back the way they found it. This far west, the buildings could slip into the Hudson, and who would miss them, miss me? This far west, it's all construction, someone's good idea. Each high-rise becomes another high-rise stacked against the soon-to-be black sky. Twilight's only bearable in the city, lights making something different than daylight, little lies saying, you're not really alone. This is the life we asked for, and it's everything we expected. There's nowhere else so light and dark at the same time. Because there's nowhere to go when we die, our lives really can be summed up by so many buildings between two rivers. And because they're unfinished, the sky behind glows pink and gray inside them. What I wanted, age 8. I wanted Adam Nelson to coach our intramural basketball team with his shirt off. He was Kevin's older brother, and I was full body tingle when he'd say my name, tug my shorts, grunt, good play. I wanted eighth grade boys to wear mesh shirts and tank tops, to throw big red balls into shiny, wet arms. I wanted boys to hold my hand like they did the girls. I wanted them to tie me up and make me kiss them. I wanted to cuddle with Magnum P.I., put my chin on his hairy chest and blow. I wanted Eric Estrada on Chips to strip, to shoot someone, then flash his armpits. I wanted the men my dad hung out with to walk around naked when we camped. I wanted all men in nothing but towels to watch them drop those towels in locker rooms, oh locker rooms. I wanted Tommy Shaw to do push-ups and show me his muscles. I wanted Ron Taylor to do push-ups and show me his muscles. I wanted Todd McCafferty to sit on my lap and show me his muscles. I wanted someone to show me his muscles. I wanted to play husband and wife. He'd be the husband and I'd be the wife. I wanted boys to protect me on the playground. I wanted boys to chase me on the playground, to shove their fingers in my mouth, push me down.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Aaron Smith. He's reading from his second book entitled Appetite. Aaron, I wanted to ask you about this idea of proximity, that, you know, when I listen to your poems, you know I'm a fan of your poems.
Thank you.
So let's get that right out there. But I love the immediacy of voice, the feeling of being present, and almost like as listeners or readers, like we're inside the poem. And I wonder if you could talk about that, how you arrive there on the page, how you get that feeling of, it's almost intimacy on the page.
I spend a lot of time thinking about the poems before I write them. Sometimes I know poets are like, boom, they have an idea and they run and write it down. And I definitely have moments where I'm struck with an image, but I think I do carry at least the impression of the idea around. I don't start solving the poem in my head as much as it's sort of like something I'm thinking about and feeling. So when I come to sit down to write it, I think that on some level I've embodied it a lot sort of in my head and in my body and my gut. So when I write it, I'm trying to be as real in the experience, as present as I can when I'm writing it. And hopefully, you know, you can't control what a listener or a reader is going to think, but I hope that that comes across to them, this sort of willingness to be as completely present in the poem as I can. And also, I think even in the process of writing it, I try to be as completely present as I can. And I hope that that translates.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, but we know there are other writers who try to do that and can't or don't. And I guess I'm thinking about craft and what kind of things you do to get us there on the page, to get us so involved in the poem.
It's funny. I tell my students a lot, because as you said, I do teach, that if they're writing at a space that I think makes them uncomfortable, that there's probably something there. A lot of our discomfort, I think, is outward. It comes at us from our culture, our society, any censoring sort of energy that we might get, whether it be cultural or family. And I think being willing to share those spaces that some people find intimate, too taboo, however we use that word, I think that is where people seem to resonate more. Sometimes I have students come into class and they're really panicked because they've written a poem. They think they can't show anyone. And I always tell them, I've never had anyone do that where anyone in the class has been like, I can't believe you said that. Mm-hmm. They're always like, I'm so grateful. Thank you so much for saying that. But it's also, as you mentioned, it's also a craft issue. It's also about how can we be as clear? How can I'll take my own aesthetic? How can I be as clear as possible? Clarity and craft and word choice ties into honesty for me, not wanting to hide behind some of the things that I'm saying, but wanting to say them clearly, beautifully, not wanting to tuck something in. I want it to be clear. I think one reason I was drawn to poetry is I think sometimes we make it precious. The culture at large makes it precious. And I'm constantly telling my students, it's very durable. It's very tough. It can handle anything you want to put in it. So the only limitation is really you limiting. So I think showing up honestly, making those decisions regarding craft and clarity and choosing, the right words in the right order, which we hear a lot, but there's truth to that. And the real basic rule, showing, not telling. I know writers get so sick of hearing that, but it's true. I go back a lot. Am I really, really showing this? Am I really showing the real experience of this and not just the idea or what we've decided is the experience of it? Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. You have a poem, a long poem called I Like the Part in your book Appetite. And I think you were going to read part of that.
Sure. So this poem is an homage to the writer Joe Brainard, and he has a whole book, a book-length poem called I Remember. And he was known as a collage artist, a visual artist. And then he wrote this wonderful book where every phrase, stanza, begins with I remember. And it really opened up a lot of space. So this is an homage. I love pop culture and movies. And I wanted to see really how many movie references I could get into one book, into one poem, and if I could keep it interesting. So I hope I succeeded. This is an excerpt from a much longer poem. I love the part in Casino Royale where Daniel Craig is tied naked to a chair, and the guy who's about to torture him says, "Wow, you've taken good care of your body." It's almost as gay as the part where he emerges from the water in the blue Speedo. I love the part in Dead Man Walking where Susan Sarandon is crying through the bars of Sean Penn's jail cell, but she's also kind of making an orgasm face. I love the part in American Beauty where Chris Cooper is wet and kisses Kevin Spacey in the garage. It's cliche for the military guy to be closeted, but it's still really hot. I love the part in Magnolia where Tom Cruise has his pants at his ankles and his penis flops to the left in his white briefs. It looks so big, I can't stop staring at it. I wonder if it's fake. I love the part in My Own Private Idaho where River Phoenix gets blown by the lumpy man and the barn falls and shatters in the road. It's hard to enjoy it, though, because I can't stop thinking he's dead. I love the part in Moonstruck where Cher is kicking the can, but the red sports car parked on the street is distracting. I love the part in Good Will Hunting where Robin Williams makes Matt Damon cry by repeating, "It's not your fault." Sometimes I say that to my friends, but I don't think they get the joke. I love the part in Titanic where Kate Winslet slogs through water to rescue Leonardo DiCaprio. She jumps off the boat, back on the boat. She turns around and her makeup is perfect. I love the part in Titanic where Gloria Stewart throws the necklace into the ocean and her toenails are painted bright red. I love the part in As Good As It Gets where Greg Kinnear says his father told him not to come home again because he was gay. I don't know if it's a good scene or if I just like it because I'm gay. I love the part in The Transporter where Jason Statham just has to take his shirt off to fight. I love the part in Transporter 3 where Jason Statham just has to take his shirt off to fight. I love the part in Transporter 3 where the woman makes Jason Statham do a striptease. It's sexy because he's angry and doesn't want to do it. I love the part in Crank where Jason Statham is wearing a hospital gown and stands up with a hard-on on a stolen motorcycle. I love that they play the Midnight Cowboy song. I love the part in Unfaithful where Diane Lane is giddy on the train after having sex with Olivier Martinez. I used to feel like that after seeing my chiropractor. I was totally in love with him, but he married someone else. I love the part in The Wizard of Oz where they all get makeovers. I love the part in Little Children where Kate Winslet and Patrick Wilson have sex in the basement and she slaps his ass. I love that Patrick Wilson is naked. I love the part in Watchmen where Patrick Wilson is naked. I love the part in Hard Candy where Patrick Wilson is naked. I love the part in Passengers where Patrick Wilson is naked. I love the part in Beaches where Bette Midler has to leave rehearsal because Barbara Hershey is dying. I love when she yells, "Diana, Diana, get my bag. It sounds so glamorous." I love the part in A Single Man where Colin Firth tries to figure out the best way to shoot himself in the head. It made me think of my father's father who killed himself and how the police said he shot himself twice because the first time didn't do it.
I'm just taking all that in. I was going to talk about how great it is to hear all those movies and all those references. And then even though I've read that poem before, I still was surprised by the grandfather again, because it's such a stark difference in there, although related.
It surprises me, too. That poem is long, so I can start reading it at different places. And it really does seem to have a different experience depending on where I start. And as it moves, the poem does sort of move toward endings of movies. So it does have almost like an arc in a little bit. But I really thought it was important to have, humor, but also undercut with those serious moments, including the River Phoenix moment, which is serious. And I think that makes it more poignant and balanced and authentic in the experience for the reader and surprising. I think it's easy to sort of get used to, I love the part over and over. Mm-hmm. And I think those moments sort of keep people listening and knowing that more than one note's going to be hit. And
right. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's easy to get lost listening to that because you go into the movies, and which is a great place to go.
Yeah. And I wanted to have a poem where if people even hadn't seen all the movies, they might still be engaged with the experience of me talking about it.
Yeah.
So there's hopefully identification and liking the movie, but also a curiosity. And then if you're not somebody who follows popular culture, and interest in just sort of the speaker's take on the movie.
Sure. I've heard you talk before about popular culture as related to gay culture, as related to working class experience. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you could address any of that in terms of the place of I Love the Part in your book.
Mm-hmm. I really, the more I think about it, I think the popular culture is a working class aesthetic. I now work in Cambridge, which is sort of, the default hub of intellectualism in the United States, and I can giggle about that too. I want to write a poem called Feeling Dumb in Cambridge. It's a little pretentious, but lovely at times too. But there's something about, I think, really realizing my working class background when I'm there. And my colleagues might be discussing Hamlet. And I'm like, oh my gosh, did you see what happened to Kim Kardashian on The Kardashians? And I went really low on purpose on that reference just then. But what I mean by working class, though, I grew up and my parents never discouraged reading. They would be happy if I read, but that wasn't what most of my friends were doing. People were outside playing. People were working a lot. there were magazines in the house, but there was TV. And I think particularly as a queer kid, a queer working class kid, you see movies and film as this other life, as a life that's possible. That's where I sort of, you know, fell in love with the idea of New York City years before I moved there and loved it. And so I think there's something about that. It's I don't know. I often think a lot, like, is it ever possible to sort of catch up when you didn't grow up in a house where people were reading all these books and you were constantly thinking, but I wouldn't trade my other experience. It's like my default mythology. Some people make Greek references. I reference Cher and Moonstruck. and I think that's okay. And I like to tell my students, whatever that is that you have, bring that to the literature, bring that to what you're doing. And if you tell it well enough, even the people who may not have exact experience with it will somehow connect to it. We'll connect and be able, you know, the personal, as we say, goes into the universal and it becomes, you know, a collective experience.
Okay. I know you have a new book that's coming out this fall, University of Pittsburgh Press, called
Yes.
Primer.
Yes.
You don't know the exact month?
I don't. They have it. And it's this fall is what I've been told.
Okay. Well, congratulations on
that. Thank you. I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, me too. And I know you're going to read some poems from that also. So
sure. I thought how you mentioned the grandfather line from the last poem, I thought I would read a poem that sort of takes up that part of that poem and goes a little bit deeper. And it starts with a line from the movie, it was a play first, The Boys in the Band. And the title of the poem is, "Not All Faggots Bump Themselves Off at the End of the Story." My father's father drove to the desert, shot himself twice in the head, left his wife only his wallet, his watch, no note or money, no plan to carry her. I've talked friends into staying, told students that I won't glorify suicide in poems, that if they say they're going to hurt themselves, I'll report them. Even after years of the pills working, years after leaving that church, after telling friends I used to wake up and make the decision every day between going to work or killing myself, there's that part of me that I'm not supposed to talk about that keeps those who love me awake at night. I can still read about someone who cashed it in, who called it all off, and I think so lucky. Still life with gun. When Dad worked midnights, Mom hid his pistol in the kitchen in a basket of plastic flowers. I can get to it, she said, before someone can get in the door. She kept it by the bed before almost shooting my father when he came home early without calling. We joked sleepwalking could have been her defense, but something changed after she saw her husband at gunpoint. Something flipped, a safety switch in her head. After I go to bed, will you hide the steak knives that are on the counter? Afraid she would get up, stab us accidentally. An article she'd read claimed in a dream state, the brain remembers where objects are placed. Years later, I asked why she thought the gun was safer. Wouldn't your mind know it was on the table? I don't know, she said. Maybe I thought the flowers would distract me. Nobody kills their whole family with daisies. Liquid. The men of Cambridge jog shirtless this morning, like it's normal to be beautiful and looked at. Unsecreted from coats but not yet tan, their meaty chest weave among overdressed pedestrians. I'm suddenly shy when the young guy with plum nipples, liquid shoulders taps my shoulder. You drop this, a post-it I wrote on between his finger and thumb. Coffee in my one hand and a bag in the other. He pushes the note deep in my shirt pocket, his knuckles to my nipple, like they were always supposed to be there. So it doesn't fall out again, he grins. He winks, palms my shoulder like a father or boyfriend. He knows that he knows how to dissolve me. I better catch up with my girlfriend. The gesture raw, exposed as the hair on his flat, damp belly, as the phone shoved in his shorts against his hip bone. Lessons. In my father's retirement, he's learning to play the banjo. 2 hours each day, runs and vamping in the back of the house. He goes to camps where they teach him to play by ear. Something has to click. When I took piano as a kid, he never wanted to listen, attended recitals because mom forced him, relieved when I finally quit. Such a sissy instrument. Now there's something innocent in the way he talks, a gentleness I rarely find in men. From your last visit to this one, am I getting better? I'm happy to lie, to say yes. I'm not a father. I don't have to be cruel. Primer for men. Run your finger down a man's spine. If he arches his back, he's a bottom. Run your finger down a man's spine, and if he doesn't arch his back, he's a bottom. Beautiful men always know they're beautiful, and not every man is beautiful. You'll never have perfect abs in 30 days. Your biceps can get bigger, but even men get stretch marks. You can't please your lover every time, so come first and fast. If he took a cab to see you, give him a towel for cleanup. If he was bad in bed, give him toilet paper. Tell him to use a sock if you don't want him to stay over. Try not to let him stay over. You should never wear a Speedo unless you're someone who should always wear a Speedo. When you kiss a man with scruff, don't say his face feels like sandpaper. He's being tender when he kisses you and doesn't have language for the sadness that passes through skin. It was rough-knuckled out of him when he was a kid. Say dry washcloth or favorite sweater, something useful and plain that won't embarrass him. Don't embarrass him unless you think he needs to be embarrassed. It's better to say nothing. Trace your lips in the kitchen and think of it. Don't ask him to change the shirt he's worn for days. Instead, sniff the armpits, lick the faint yellow stains. Watch him shower. Watch him dry off in the hard bathroom light. Study every mole, each hair on his shoulder. Don't be cautious. It's just a body. Don't ask if he's going to call. Don't ask him to be brave. Never ask a man to shave.
It's the poetry of Aaron Smith. Thank you so much. That was so good.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.